Salutations, Mets fans, and welcome to another edition of Amazing Avenue Audio, the official podcast of your SB Nation New York Mets site, Amazing Avenue. I'm your host, Jeffrey Paternostro, and back with me this week for our second podcast is Rob Castellano. Rob, how'd you spend your time off? That wasn't really time off, I guess, technically.
Binging on as much baseball as possible. Audio, television, internet, anything I could get my hands on.
Which you can do now because it is definitely baseball season. I will chide you briefly for leaving me with noted Josh Satin hater Greg Karam earlier in the week. But bygones are bygones. It's time to talk minor leagues. Because, look, we could cover the major league team, but let's just get this out of the way. They're not going to win a game this year and move on to the important stuff, which is the Mets Minors affiliates. It's opening day right now. And this is our Amazing Avenue Audio 2014 Mets Minor League Preview. Later in the show, you'll also have your emails and the debut of the Amazing Avenue Audio drinking game. But we will kick things off in episode 62. The Elvin Ramirez could probably be of use in the Mets bullpen at this moment edition with Mets Trivia. Because Rob is back on the show, which means I get to flail at Mets Trivia, though I am running a one-question winning streak coming into this episode. So let's do it.
Yeah, and I feel like you should probably get this one. But
I assume it's minor league related, so I may have a puncher's chance.
It is. And since you follow me on Twitter, you've pretty much already seen the answer, but I feel like this is a extra topical question in that, one, it's minor league related, and two, it falls on a very special anniversary. The question is, who was the first team to sign Tom Seaver with the understanding that, you know, it's not going to be the Mets? That would be slightly too easy.
It would be. I think I do know the answer to this question, but as is tradition, we'll leave it to the end of the show for our listeners out there to ruminate on as well. And we'll get right into our Mets minor league preview. And we're not going to go level by level like we did last year, because last year, if I recall correctly, took 2.5 hours. And we're trying not to do that. So we're just going to toss out some discussion points. All four affiliates are playing tonight, three of them playing currently as we record on Thursday evening. We actually, I think, have mostly full rosters for everyone other than St. Louis, because that's what always happens. I forget who did this on Twitter, but no one's like tweeting out. Actually, it might have been Greg on the podcast on Tuesday. No one's tweeting out selfies of them driving from from the backfield to the front fields of St. Lucie. And they're just lazy about getting it out. And I don't think they have like a dedicated reporter either, like Vegas, Savannah, and Binghamton do.
There's no Mike Harrington.
There's no...
Sadly.
For good or for ill. Since we have all the rosters, what is the most surprising assignment to you?
Most surprising assignment? I feel like there's sort of just like one elephant in the room sort of answer, being Dominic Smith and Savannah. Not that he doesn't deserve it, but, you know, the front office has generally proven to be relatively conservative. Their last couple of high school draft picks, Nimmo and Cicchini, both began their pro careers in short season ball. And for whatever reason, Smith is viewed in a more polished light, and so it seems that he will begin in Savannah.
Yeah, you know, we've sort of discussed this on the podcast. It was a major topic in last year's minor league preview when they sent Gavin Cicchini to extend his spring training into Brooklyn, and they did it obviously the year before with Nimmo. And with Nimmo, you could make the excuse that he signed late and didn't play much, and Cicchini was injured in Kingsport. So I guess Smith was going to be the real test case on whether or not this is sort of, you know, going to be standard operating procedure for this front office, and clearly it's not, because Smith is starting for the Savannah Sandnats tonight. I'm going to go in a slightly different direction, and I am going to pick Domingo Tapia repeating Advanced Day. I guess I kind of saw it coming, but for me, I guess the way I would frame it is this. He did not have a great 2013. Control was an issue. He missed time with a couple small injuries. But the Binghamton rotation is just, I feel like the innings in Binghamton would be better served given someone like Tappy. And even Fulmer, though I understand with Fulmer it is more of a reps issue. They want him to get more reps at that level. Healthy reps at advanced day, because he didn't throw nearly as many innings as Tapia did, though Tapia's were not particularly efficient. I just think those innings are better suited to be used on Domingo Tapia than, Greg Peavy or Darren Gorski or Tyler Pill from a player development standpoint.
Yeah, it's fair. It's a good point. I think probably what you said about the control and that huge regression that he made is probably the sticking point for the organization in making that call, but I would agree.
They did promote Hansel Robles, though, who admittedly is older, but had a similarly kind of, I don't want to say lost year, but similarly mediocre year in St. Lucie in 2013.
Yeah, true. So, sort of annoying. Wouldn't have minded seeing Tapia in Binghamton, and you're right, we sort of expected it, but I was hoping for the surprise there.
And of course, it's personally annoying to both of us because we're going to see a decent amount of that Binghamton rotation, and it's not particularly inspiring at the moment. Which brings us to the worst team to watch as of opening day, and I think we both probably have the same answer here.
Yeah, that'll be Binghamton.
That roster might be older than me. It has at least one player that's older than me. It has Brian Bergamy, who I think is like 33. But from a prospect standpoint, it's difficult to get excited. It's a bunch of arms repeating the level. It's a bunch of position players repeating the level. It's a bunch of other arms that probably end up as middle relievers or AAA guys, and Kevin Plawecki.
Yeah, I was going to say, he's sort of like the one, bright spot where when you look at the lineup, the box score every morning, you're pretty much going to look for Plawecki and then move on.
I really should have it up in front of me, but it's kind of crazy how many players on that roster this year have already, you're actually going to bring me up, yeah, that have actually, played either all or parts of a season in Binghamton previously. I count, and the only, let's put it this way, it'll be easier to count the guys with no previous double-A experience. And for the pitchers, that's Matt Bowman, TJ Chisholm. I feel like Ryan Frazier's pitched there
before, yeah, he did,
at least at some point. Hansel Robles. I don't think Satterwhite got there.
No, Satterwhite didn't. He was in A-ball.
I feel like Velasquez has pitched in double-A at some point in his life.
Yeah, he's been in the Eastern League, just not in this organization. He was with the Iron Pigs.
Creo and Forsyth were both there last year. So Plawecki's new. Chase Boyd is new. Matt Reynolds. Kyle Johnson. And that's the list. Well, I guess Lawley had AAA time, not AA time, but whatever. It's just not. They have two guys on the roster under 23, one of whom is Wilfredo Tovar. I'm not saying it's going to be a bad team from a performance standpoint. I think it'll actually be pretty good, but it's just, I'm going to sit on them end of next week, and it's just not. Be prepared for a lot of notes on Kevin Plawecki, basically.
Yeah, not a ton of new data points to be gathered here. There are names to watch. You've named a few of them. I guess to sort of backtrack a bit, a surprising one is Jack Leathersich not getting the call to AAA and beginning the year in Binghamton. Sort of a surprise to me.
Well, I wonder if AAA is more of like a holding pen for them this year than it usually is, and they don't see Leathersich as being close enough to Major League ready. Or it could just be like with Tapia. It's if you do not throw strikes, you will be punished, essentially, has been the sort of the organization's position. And you see it, it's not just at the upper levels, you see it at the lower levels. I mean, the guys they've pushed, guys like Yanoa, Sessa, Robert Selman certainly can pound the zone, but guys that can pound the zone are going to get ahead of sort of the, the Akil Morris types of the world who, at this point certainly aren't as good a prospect as that previous list, but at one time or another were more sort of well-regarded, high upside type arms.
Yeah, just look at how fast Montero moved.
Yeah, if you throw strikes and you can beat a path to Queens, basically. So what's conversely, what's the team you're going to be watching the closest this year of the full season affiliates?
I think it'll probably be Vegas. And that's a good point to call out, because the short season teams are their own beast. There's a couple of interesting ones to watch there, but that aside, I think Vegas is probably going to be the one for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's understandable. It has sort of the guys that are going to help, and I mean the best prospects, in addition to the guys that are going to help in 2014, ideally. You don't need to know the names: Thor, Montero, DeGrom, Pueyo. Just like pure sex dripping off the tongue. But for me, I think St. Lucie is kind of the obvious choice with guy. I mean, if you want to go volume, just in terms of if you look at the Amazon Avenue top 20 prospect list, I think St. Lucie probably has the most names on that to start off the season, especially with Fulmer and Tapia repeating. I mean, what are there, 5 starters in the top 20 with Tapia, Fulmer, Yanoa, Sessa, and Matz? Maybe Sessa just missed. I can't remember offhand, but certainly 5 legitimate pitching prospects out of the 6 starters there, or the 6 starting rotation spots. I don't know exactly how they're going to divvy up time. But I'm actually going to get to watch St. Lucie because I can't get down to Florida, so I'm picking Savannah, which has 2 first-round picks in Dominic Smith and Gavin Cecchini, and a not quite as high-end prospect-y rotation, but I think some interesting arms there. Just guys I haven't seen, like Whalen and Flexen. I'm curious to see if they stretch out Kevin McGowan as a starter. Robert Selman, we'll do our guys later in the list, but Robert Selman's one of my guys. John Gant, even without the hair, sadly, is interesting. I think there's some things they could do to get him a little more velocity, and I'm curious to see how he looks now in full season ball, working with Mark Valdez, if they can, and with a full spring, if they can get him sort of, he could be a guy that could, if not break out, maybe establish himself as an interesting arm, if nothing else. And I'm going to get to see them, actually, at the end of the month. So, and also Dominic Smith. So,
yeah, it's based on Smith alone, it's an interesting team. And sort of the common link, and this is just sort of something that we've learned about this front office and the organization in general over the last few years. It's nice to be able to look at each list, and regardless of whether or not it's a team that we're thrilled to watch or sort of not as much, pretty much every team we can say, there's interesting arms here.
That might be a stretch in Binghamton. I mean, I think Binghamton will be much more interesting. Maybe as soon as the end of May, I could see Tapia and Fulmer. I think Fulmer, he makes 6 starts that are good and he's healthy. They're gonna bump him pretty quickly. And one of the things about having guys like PV Pill and Gorski in the rotation is those aren't guys that are gonna block anyone. Certainly not a pitching prospect of the class of Mike Fulmer. But even Tapia, I could see him sort of following the Jairus Familia track from a few years ago, where Familia had that bad season in high A, had to repeat the level, but figured things out pretty quickly and moved up, I think, after 7 or 8 starts. So, by the time they get to New Britain at the end of May, fingers crossed on my end, certainly, it could be a little bit more interesting roster. But, 3 out of 4 really interesting prospect-laden affiliates is nothing to sneeze at.
Yeah, actually, I took that into account a little bit when sort of rating the teams, because St. Lucie was pretty high on my list, but there's sort of that potential that they have a number of guys who could move, by the All-Star game at the very latest, with Fulmer, Tapia, even Nimmo, I feel, could be in Binghamton by, maybe not quite the All-Star break, maybe a little later, but by season's end, it could easily be Binghamton that is that's a little bit more entertaining for the prospect watcher.
Yeah, St. Lucie tends to be where they sort of take the kid gloves off, and if you hit, you can hit your way to Binghamton after the. I mean, they usually don't do anything before the All-Star break. They keep the first, try to win the first half title or whatever. But I could see, not just, I think Tapia and Fulmer could be up before then, but Nimmo could hit his way in the second half. Dilson Herrera, Yanoa and Matz, Sessa, any of those guys. I mean, this is sort of the level where the kid gloves, as I said, come off, and they're sort of more comfortable, I think, keeping younger guys in Savannah for the full year, especially because they don't promote from within, from Brooklyn, sort of give reinforcement. So they're going to keep guys, especially younger guys. I mean, someone like Plawecki was always going to hit his way out of Savannah. You know, LJ Mazzilli will probably hit his way out of Savannah. But St. Lucie, the second half is not, well, Savannah is usually the second half, not interesting as the first half, because everybody sort of moves up that's going to move up. But, you know, it could be, you're right, it could be a very different sort of, we can have a very different conversation about this around the time short season ball affiliates start up.
Yeah, and even another name that sort of goes in hand with Fulmer and Tapia is Mats. I mean, he could move as fast as any of them if he's sort of as dominant as he was in Savannah.
I think he's actually older than both, too. Maybe not Tapia, but he's definitely older than Fulmer.
Well, yeah, exactly, based on his age and the fact that he's sort of rounding into form, and it seems like, you know, he's probably ready to take that next step and catch up in terms of the development curve. He's a guy who I could see in Binghamton, you know, before potentially anybody.
All right, what team affiliate, that is, will win the most games this year?
I'll stick with the 51s because, like you said, there's the star power. There's like three or four of the top five prospects in the organization, but then you've got your sort of veteran presence in Abreu and Daisuke, whether or not he actually pitches there. But then you also have like your depth sort of prospect guys who are going to just make a killing offensively at the very least in Lutz and Dykstra, Campbell. Guys who are going to put up numbers, but then like moderate prospects like, you know, Dendecker, Nieuweneis, DeGrom, Jeff Walters. It's just, you know, in all different sort of respects, there are talented pieces that I think are going to make them a formidable team this year.
Yeah, Vegas is so weird. I know they were good last year. They don't quite have the quad A type guys I feel like they had last year, or, you know, guys from the major league level coming down, though who knows with the way the Mets are playing right now, so that could happen sooner rather than later. I'm gonna go with St. Lucie, and not just because they're winning 6-2 right now on a TJ Rivera grand slam, but they always seem to do well. They have a mix of, you know, prospects that I think will hit and pitch well. I think they'll pitch. I mean, exceedingly good pitching staff, and they'll get a boost from Tapia and Fulmer being there in the first half. But it just, like, looking at this lineup, it's, you know, a pretty good high A lineup. And their starting rotation, we previously mentioned, is good. And Ryan Ellis always gets the most out of his players. So I think it's going to be St. Lucie.
Yeah, Ryan Ellis is someone that I just wouldn't bet against because to this point he's been ultra successful at pretty much every level.
All right, who will be the first Mets prospect called up to the big leagues this year?
Probably Vic Black, just based on
Oh, you didn't count Vic Black. Vic Black has major league, someone without any major league service time.
Without service time.
Black picking a reliever. Jesus.
I was going to say, just name me another reliever who's in Las Vegas.
So you're with like Jeff Walters who could be up by the end of the week or something like that?
Yeah, or DeGrom or Carreño, although I think Carreño has service time.
Yeah, he had pitched a little with the Blue Jays, I think.
Yeah, it's not so much the player, it's the team. The team, the turmoil right now in the bullpen is just palpable, and it's going to have to give at some point. They're going to have to, you know, try something different, and that'll be somebody from Las Vegas. Like I said, Black is the easy choice, but, you know, any of those names are fair game.
All right. You ruined my question, Rob.
Save it.
You pick an actual prospect. But
salvage it.
See, I thought you were going to go with Montero or Thor, because I forgot you would just pick a fringy relieving prospect. But I'm actually saying Cesar Pueyo. Chris Young is hurt. And they seem to have been more willing in the past to go with bats pre-Super 2. I mean, they did it with Lagares last year. They did it with Kirk when there was an injury the year before. It's kind of actually interesting to me, too, because you tend to think of position player prospects is more stable, you know, more likely to, you know, last 6 years in general than pitching prospects would be. Though someone should, I don't know if that's actually true. Someone that's not me and has time on their hands should do a study on that. But I don't, just for some reason, I think you could see, you're not going to see Thor or Montero before June 15th. I think you could see Pueyo before that. And I don't count fringe reliever prospects. So there you are.
Yeah, you're right, though. I think they've definitely set the precedent that they're more willing to bring up a hitter as a temporary option than with pitchers. You've actually heard them say, when they're up, we want them to be up. We don't want this to be a back and forth sort of thing. Whereas with hitters, it seems that they don't really mind doing that. And maybe it is. Maybe it's because of what you said, that hitters are generally viewed as a more stable commodity, so they don't really respond adversely to that sort of jerking around, whether that's true or not. But, you know, it seems that the front office definitely thinks so.
All right. For 2014... who is looking at a make or break year for their prospect status?
Make or break year. I guess it depends on like to what degree. Like, I could say like Corey Vaughn.
Yeah, I mean like a guy like in the top 20 at least.
Yeah.
I think.
Well, that's how I sort of look at it, because like with Vaughn, we sort of know the limitations there.
Yeah, I just don't see him doing a lot this year to change sort of what he is.
Well, Vaughn specifically, what I would say is, like, is he going to be a major leaguer? And this year will show us that. But, you know, the ceiling is so low compared to what it used to be that it doesn't really matter. If we want to talk about someone who matters, I would go with Tapia. Not to, you know, beat a dead horse. We've discussed him a little bit already. But he's a guy who, you know, he had the concerns about command, but, you know, it wasn't just concerns. This is a 14% walk rate. Like, that's regression to the max, to the point that scares me. And if there isn't some bounce back, suddenly the questions, like those lingering concerns about a move to the bullpen, I think suddenly that's sort of a slam dunk, and the idea of a starter is out the window if he doesn't bounce back this year pretty hard.
I think you're right. He just turns into the hard-throwing relief prospect that can't throw strikes, and the Mets have no shortage of those right now, as we are well aware. I'm actually going to go... This probably isn't fair. I'm going to go with Gavin Cecchini. He's only 20. he's in Savannah, so there's plenty of time for any number of things to happen with him. But I just... he's not a tools guy. So it's not like with Cesar Pueyo or Wilmer Flores or even Lagares to a certain extent, where you could forgive poor production in the low minors because, well, you know, he's a tools guy. They sometimes get it late. And if he does get it, there's like, wow. You know, as we saw with Flores 2 years ago and Pueyo last year, when they do get it, it's something special. With Cecchini, you know, he's not going to suddenly blossom into a plus power guy or a plus runner or an elite defensive shortstop. So for him, and again, I don't like to look at low minors statistics per se, performance, however you want to quantify it. But he's a guy that if he's not producing on the field in some capacity, I'm not saying he has to go out and hit 330, but if he's not showing you some level of production, there's not much to dream on that he'll suddenly, like, there's nothing for him to get, basically, I guess is the best way to put it.
Yeah, I definitely buy that. And I would say he's another top candidate in that sort of vein, because you're right. What's he going to do if not sort of produce in the low minors? And you know, I'd even toss... you know, I wanted to say Brandon Nimmo here. He's a guy who, I mean, my number one concern with him has been, you know, similarly, he hasn't really done all that much. The production hasn't been great. And it's been like 3 years now where he just hasn't done all that much. There are definitely bright spots to sort of hold on to. But if this year he doesn't take a step forward, a moderate step forward, I think that's sort of a concern, especially for a guy who, not to the level of a Cecchini, but the tools aren't, you know, maybe what we thought they would be when he was drafted, though, again, very different from Cicchini, because the tools, you know, they're moderate, but they're just certainly not. I wouldn't call him a tools guy at this point.
2 for 2 with a double and a walk tonight, so hashtag promote, I guess.
Nice.
And yes, I do have all these windows open while I'm recording the podcast, because it's minor league opening day, you guys.
Seriously.
Which is already proving to be far superior to major league opening day. All right, we have some Twitter questions. I asked for some topics to discuss from the minor league end of things. So we'll start with at Mench Evans. I'd like to hear what prospects need to take a step forward to keep system in the top 10 or 15, given the graduations at the top. This is a good question, because it's, you know, realistically 4 or I guess probably the entire top 5 will likely graduate. Pueyo, to be determined, but certainly Flores, D'Arnaud, Montero, and Syndergaard are likely to age out or service time out of prospect status. So who are the guys that are going to make this, that are going to move in, that are not just going to move into the top 5 next year, but move into the top 5 and keep this a top half system in baseball?
That's a big ask. But if it was going to happen, I think you need Matz to take a big step forward, basically do what he did, but in St. Lucie this year. You need to see, you know, another year just sort of confirming Dominic Smith as an elite bat and, you know, solidly moving into the top couple positions in the system. And let's stick with the idea of Nimmo needing to really validate himself as an elite talent.
See, I think, I mean, that will all help, but I feel like to a certain extent those guys are known quantities. You could see, I think, any of the three guys you named move into to a back end of a top 100 list with a good season. I think, you know, Smith obviously made, I think, at least Keith Laws last year. But I'm looking more for, shockingly, I know, sort of that high upside Dominican dude out of nowhere. You know, whether it's Marcos Molina, Rosario, you know, those are guys I think could really give them more top 100 depth. You know, if they're gonna put 5 or 6, you know, if they don't have an elite prospect at the top, you know, a Syndergaard or Wheeler level arm, sort of the cherry on the top of the system. Just having, like, you know, 5 or 6 top 100 guys, even if they're none of them are top 50, I think will be the key there. And, you know, yes, Nimmo could get there.
I think Matz is the one for me who he sort of is a known commodity right now, but if he comes out and does what he did last year, I think he's suddenly like a top 50 arm, if not better than that.
Well, I mean, if he goes out and conquers high A quickly and pitches well in double A in the second half, gets to double A and pitches well there, yeah, I could see, you know, lefty velocity does not grow on trees. Let me look at something. I'm just curious about Matz's age. He's a 2009 draftee, so he's always older than I think he is.
I think he's like 23 now.
He'll be 23 in May. So I was going to compare him to Sean Newcomb, who's going to go in the top 10 in the draft this year, or top 15 or so probably. But Newcomb's going to be 21 on draft day, so it's not.
Slight difference.
Yeah, not a great comparison point. But, I mean, to my larger point, lefty velocity does not grow on trees. So, you know, that's something I could see happening, I suppose.
Yeah, to me, it would be a situation where Matz sort of turns himself into that cherry on top sort of guy, like follows up in the footsteps of Wheeler and Syndergaard and, you know, takes the baton as the next, you know, stud young power pitcher in the Mets system.
Great. Next question is from at SidFinch21. And another Domingo Tapia question. Is Tapia ready for a bounce back season? Throwing more strikes? Yes, he will have to throw more strikes in order to have a bounce back season. I don't think that's what you're asking. I mean, yeah, he's my guy to have a bounce back season. based on nothing at the moment, but I mean, dude throws 98-mile-an-hour fastballs, so that will cover a multitude of sins if he can start locating them.
Yeah, and beyond that, we've seen it before. It's not as if he's had, you know, a checkered history of, you know, throwing strikes here and there. He threw strikes pretty consistently up until last season. I really don't know what happened.
Yeah, I mean, you never... I mean, we'll see what 2014 brings, but I would not bet against Domingo Tapia because, as you may well know, I'm not in the business of doing that. Our next one is from at Farouk Ahmed 04. Your picks for the 2014 Rafael Montero Zero to Hero Award. I mean, I guess, okay. So I figure Montero on everybody's list in 2012, other than John Mayo's, was like, you know, back end top 30. So who's like, who's the guy that makes the biggest jump this year, I guess?
Oh, man, I guess it depends where we want to sort of begin. Like, if we want to look at someone who's like off the radar, who is in the discussion all of a sudden, a name that I like is Logan Taylor.
Okay. And is he healthy right now?
I think so. Yeah, I think I saw, at least, I mean, I wasn't there, but I think I saw footage of him.
Okay.
In spring training, throwing and warming up. I don't know that I ever saw him on the mound, but
yeah, I thought he had Tommy John last year at some point, but yeah, maybe I'm confusing him with somebody else.
No, I think he did. So there's a good chance we won't see him until, you know, at least the days that start to get a little warmer, like maybe into May or June, because he only pitched, he only made 7 appearances last year. So, you know, 12 months would be, you know, before the break. So we could see some significant innings from him. And he's a guy who, you know, coming into the injury last year was just sort of starting to make a name for himself. You know, big 6'5", 200-plus pounder, hit 95, 96. He's a guy who I feel, if healthy and, you know, free to get out there and do his thing, could suddenly, you know, jump into the discussion as like a, hey, who the hell is this guy? He's a name we really have to pay attention to.
Yeah, I saw him in, I don't think I, did I see him out of the pen in Savannah? I definitely saw him in Brooklyn, and it's, you know.
You did not see him out of the pen in Savannah because he made 7 appearances, all starts.
All starts. So I didn't see him, and he wasn't even like piggybacking. I mean, if he was piggybacking, he was the first guy. So I didn't see him in Savannah. But I did see him in Brooklyn. You're right. It's big fastball, big curve, big dude. So yeah, why not? I did not expect that. So kudos to you.
I know how you like to go off the board.
It's a good off the board pick. I am going to go with, I had this tweet sitting here for like 2 hours, and I'll just go with Jared King. Well, it's Champ. If Champ Stewart had started in Savannah, I would have absolutely said Champ Stewart. He's a guy who I don't think is on enough radars yet, but I don't know how much, you know, a college guy, admittedly a younger and rawer college guy, you know, assigned for the second time to short season ball can really move the needle. No, he's a guy that maybe they do break the rule, and if he's really good and extended and good in Brooklyn, they give him a little taste of Savannah by the end of the year, because he's a little bit older. But I'm going to go with Jared King, who's starting in Savannah, because I like Jared King. And
we have come to know that.
It's a polished college bat. He could move quickly, another guy that could hit St. Lucie by the All-Star break. You know, you sort of almost expect it, I think. A guy with that pedigree to mash in the way ball. At least you would hope so.
Or at least steal a shitload of bases.
Yeah, or do, you know, do something. Perform well, I guess, would be the way to put it.
Are we back on King? I'm thinking Stewart. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, okay. Yeah, King's like an average runner. He's not slow or anything, but yeah. Yeah, I think King's the guy that could hit his way out of Savannah as like a polished college bat. And maybe, I mean, I think he could definitely get into the, probably not the top 10, but a guy that could be like around number 15. I just think Montero was such a weird thing. And people knew about Montero, I guess. Sort of. I mean, I was writing about him. You were writing about him. Mayo obviously loved him, but.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like looking for the quote-unquote next Montero is just setting ourselves up for disappointment.
Yeah, if you know who the next Rafael Montero is, send your resume to care of Sandy Alderson and whatever the Mets address is.
Yeah, and that's assuming there is one. I mean, it doesn't happen that often. So.
Dude went through, what, 6 levels in 2 years? DSL, yeah. 5 levels in 2 years? Yeah, DSL in 2011 to AA in 2013, that does not happen that often.
Yeah, I mean, there are fast risers, and I think that's what the question is asking. But in terms of, like, specifically Monteros, you need, like, such a combination of exceptions. Like, the fact that he signed at 20 and sort of was forgotten about for his late teenage years and was sort of ignored, like, that doesn't happen often. With a guy who's going to pitch in the majors, for that to happen is so rare.
No, it is. It's like Rafael Montero is. I guess there is no new Rafael Montero. He's one of a kind.
Indeed.
Or at least certainly rare enough that I can't, you know, pick one in the system as it currently stands.
Unless it's Logan Taylor.
Okay, unless it's Logan Taylor. Our final tweet is from @Mike_overboard, and I left the best for last. Best hair power rankings with Mejia and Queens, DeGrom take over first. Find out tonight on Amazing Avenue Auto. He even wrote the promo for us. Oh. So is DeGrom your hair guy now?
Well, he's definitely vying for that position. I don't know that I would necessarily... I don't know that anyone will ever topple Mejia, but...
Well, no. But I mean, I think he means among the prospect ranks.
Among the prospect ranks. Yeah, I'd say it has to. I mean, kudos to you, Jeff Walters.
And he's given. See, Walters, I think, was better last year. I think this year there's just a little too much Arroyo in it. Yeah. For me to give him the nod over DeGrom,
which they actually referenced on one of the spring training broadcasts in an interview with Walters. Arroyo's name came up, and there was some discussion of cornrows, which immediately terrifies. And also sort of intrigues me.
Mostly terrifies me. John Gant would have been a competitor. Would have made a strong push, I think, here. But decided he's close crop now. He's well shorn. I don't. And when you have the flow, you got to let the flow free.
Yeah, you're not gonna be remembered for your crew cut.
And I will say this is all provisional, assuming Cesar Pueyo does not grow his fro back, in which case he's number one.
Yeah, he could rock the fro. All
right, we'll wrap up our Mets minor league preview for 2014. I don't want to call it the lightning round. I guess what's the Loogie round, maybe? Does that work? quick appearances.
Okay, I got it.
All right, you got the fact that I had to explain it probably did not bode well for its future as an actual segment. But we're going to wrap things up with a list of our guys. Our guys in quotes. These guys do not necessarily have to be prospects. I think in some cases they will not be. But these are our top 10 guys in the Mets system. Rob, kick it off with your number 10.
I sort of went in tiers.
Okay.
So starting sort of up at the upper levels, I've always been a Flores guy, and I expect the bat to take hold this year at the major league level whenever he does get that extended look beyond just paternity fill-in time. No surprise that I'm on board with Steven Matz. I think this stuff is special from the left side. That said, I've brought this point up on Twitter before that I wouldn't, not that I think the organization will, but I wouldn't completely rule out the idea of potentially trading him when his value is high, because injured pitchers generally become injured pitchers in the future. So.
As I think Mets fans are well aware of at this point.
Yeah. I like Rainey Lara. I always have.
Interesting.
I've always been a Lara guy. He's sort of the guy from that initial budding of the four horsemen of Brooklyn with Robles, Lara and Sessa. He was always the one who got the least amount of ink, but put up sort of the most solid numbers of the group year over year. And I say solid, not necessarily the most eye-catching. That would probably be definitely be Yanoa. But Lara wasn't far behind him, especially in terms of his nice mix of swing and miss, but with command. So he's a guy who I think gets slightly underrated. And while he's probably not a starter at the major league level, I think that's definitely a major league one.
I think if the schedule holds, even if the schedule doesn't hold, I'll see him next week in Manchester. And I haven't seen him since Brooklyn, where, to be perfectly honest, I was not super impressed. But these aren't my guys. We'll get to my guys in a second. These are your guys. So continue.
Obviously Tovar. And I won't get too deep into that. We know that I like Tovar. The high floor is a favorite of mine.
He might be the youngest dude on that Binghamton roster. I'd have to check his birth date against Poeckes.
Yeah, every minute that what's his name, Anthony Saratelli plays short for Las Vegas and Wilmer just continues to reside in Queens really annoys me that Tovar isn't there instead. I get it if Flores is playing short at Vegas, and so if he's imminently on his way back, then fine. But that must have been a tough call for Tovar to go back to Double A after last year. I mentioned Logan Taylor. He's a guy who I expect to take a big step forward once he's back on the field this year. Getting sort of into the lower minors at this point, Luis Guillorme.
Ah, good choice.
Again, in the same mold as a Tovar, drafted last year late as a all-glove shortstop, but like an all-world glove. So he's not going to hit, but he can field the hell out of shortstop. And we know that'll carry you high enough, and we'll see what happens in Double A once he gets there. Beck Wheeler, the other Wheeler.
Beck Wheeler. Now he's the split guy, right? No, he's fastball. Who's the split? That Savannah bullpen is just one big blur in my head from last year.
No, he was just straight up like struck everybody out. Not just because he's a righty reliever.
No, I thought he throws a split. He's the fastball split guy.
Oh, okay, possible. I thought you meant a crazy platoon split, as in.
No, because I can't. There was one guy that did really well that was fastball split, and one guy that did really well that was fastball curve, and I can never remember which is which.
That's very possible. That's sort of ringing a bell, actually. But Wheeler is a guy that I like in that he struck out like a crazy, I forget what it is now, it was over 30% of batters faced out of the Nats bullpen. And also, he's an undrafted free agent, which generally you don't see such dynamic tools of any kind for an undrafted free agent. And he's a position switch. That's why he was a shortstop in college. And there's also like the weird, he had like the crippling leg injury and like a boating accident and didn't know if he'd even walk again, and has obviously bounced back pretty nicely, and even had a couple of strong, I think one or two strong appearances filling in spring training and sort of impressed on the broadcast. Moving on, Patrick Biondi. I think he was like a ninth or tenth rounder last year out of Michigan, senior. Sort of getting back to the same idea as Jared King, that polished profile, different profile, but this is that like college speedster profile that I always love. I think more than once I've uttered the words "poor man's Brett Gardner," and that's sort of how I look at Biondi, as a guy who can take a walk. In fact, really good plate discipline, doesn't strike out a lot. He didn't hit a ton in Brooklyn last year, about a 250, which for a college senior sort of underwhelms me. But he's also a guy who I always sort of hang on to the fact that he won the batting title in the Cape Cod League, which some pretty prestigious territory. Some big names have done that in the past, so I feel like there's a little bit there in terms of hit tool. And again, he's fast as hell, so it's a profile that I like. To wrap it up, the last two Now we're into the deeper, very far away low minors. Alberto Baldonado.
I knew Baldonado was going to be on your list.
Yeah, we mentioned him here before. The big, not huge, but the big lefty reliever who last year I think he pitched in Kingsport. And put up not moderate numbers, but as far as the velocity from the left side, and then the platoon splits, you know, it's a profile that could move, even if just as a potential loogie at some point. And finally, I wouldn't necessarily label him one of my guys, but just a guy that I'm sort of watching, is Victor Cruzado, another guy from Kingsport. An outfielder, old for the league, and sort of goes against your idea of production and stats at the low minor league level. Not just yours, that's just, you know, an industry sort of standard that putting up numbers in rookie ball doesn't generally portend future success. That said, put up a huge year, batted 330, showed okay power, he's a switch hitter, but showed really great plate discipline. Just someone who I'll be watching to see if, you know, whether or not it was a mirage and that he was older than his competition, or if he's sort of a polished switch hitting bat, which catches my attention in that the Mets haven't had a good switch hitter in their system for like 5 years now.
Interestingly enough, I actually got a Twitter question from him right before about him, I should say, right before we started recording. Somebody asked him, asked me if he was a guy or an all caps guy, like a guy or a guy. I said, well, I didn't see him in Kingsport. He was hurt when I was down there, but I don't use all caps on a guy that was 21 years old in the Appy.
And he's not like a big tool. I mean, he's like 5'11", 180.
Yeah, he's not. I think he was playing, I only glanced at it. I think he was playing right field tonight for Savannah.
Yeah, so
he played a little middle infield, I know, last year.
Wouldn't bet the farm that we have a major league player on our hands, but
that's really not important when it's your guy, though. Trust me, there are plenty of guys on my list that are probably not future major leaguers.
So let's hear them. Let's.
I did the ordinal ranking 10-1. Number 10 is Angel Kwan. He's on the DL to start the season for Binghamton, but this list has to have at least one soft tossing lefty. Cause it's me, and I think as I said before on the podcast, he personally makes me feel better about my future professional baseball career since we're the same size. Number 9 is Pedro Perez, who I did see last year in Kingsport. He may not hit at all. He might turn into Adelin Rodriguez, which also is sort of just a step up from not hitting at all, by the way. But
yeah,
he's young.
Good, bad, I couldn't tell.
It's not as bad as not hitting at all, but it's not a major leaguer, probably. But he's pretty young. And I saw him hit a ball at his eyes 400 feet. And I have a soft spot for, I guess to put this politely, doughy players. He's a little doughy. Number 8 is Darren Gorski, who I have not forgotten about, even if he appears to now be on the Mark Cahoon track, and that's not a great track to be on. It kind of goes like this. Step 1, okay, I can kind of see a back-end guy here if the breaking ball tightens up a little bit. Step 2, oh, it didn't tighten up a little bit. Step 3, am I really watching another Mark Cahoon start? Step 4, Mark Cahoon's still battling out there. That's cool. Step 5, Mark Cahoon has been released.
And is now a pitching coach.
Yeah. And apparently Gorski was topping out at 86, which is about where I saw him last summer, tonight for Binghamton's opening day. So yeah, it's the Mark Cahoon track down to a T, really. Number 7 is Robert Selman. I like big athletic pitchers, and Selman fits the bill. There's not much, I guess, physical projection there. But he was a guy that was like a multi-sport athlete in high school. So I think focusing full-time on pitching, you might get a little more out of him, even if it's not, you know, like a physical filling out. He does need to tighten up the curveball, but he's a guy that I'm kind of like, of the Savannah guys I'm going to see, I think I'm sort of sneaky excited about seeing him more than some other guys.
Let me hit the pause button here because I think you hit on an interesting point. That athleticism factor is something that sometimes overlooked, and I think it's important. Selman has it, and sort of as a counterpoint, Rainey Lara, one of the guys who I mentioned, he does not have an athletic delivery.
No, nothing. Yeah, it's not an adjective I would use.
And you're right. It can definitely breed a little bit more, just a little bit more velocity, or, you know, command, or what have you. And you're right, Selman is definitely a guy who I'd put near the top of that list.
Number six is the aforementioned Jared King. I like guys that are tweeners. I like guys that are fringy power from a corner with good gloves. Those guys aren't necessarily major leaguers, so sometimes I guess they turn into Juan Lagares. Again, much like the Rafael Montero track, I'm not putting Jared King on the Juan Lagares track because the Juan Lagares track is rather rare. But as I said, I think he could kill Savannah this year and at least establish himself as a top 20 guy in the system. Number five is Marcos Molina. Yes, I know, but I was talking about him before Stupid Sexy Parks had him in the top 10. I think he'd be higher, too, if I actually saw him last year. It would be I think he's an easy candidate, assuming he's in Brooklyn this year, and I get a couple looks at him, candidate for the top three, my guys, by next year. Number four is Champ Stewart. I'm annoyed he's not in Savannah, I'm not going to lie. Again, I'll get to see him plenty in Brooklyn. But and to be fair, the swing's a little rough, so maybe extended does help him, but ooh, center field tools make me feel all tingly inside. Number three is Domingo Tapia. Yep. It's a grade 70 bowling ball, two-seam fastball, and that will keep you on this list forever. Number two is Cesar Puello, who looks like Puig, probably will not hit as much as Puig, but he looks like Puig. And number one, can you guess, Rob? Can you guess?
Number one, gotta be Yanoa.
It is, indeed, Gabriel Yanoa, who did not have a great high A debut tonight, but it's a long season.
What do you do? I haven't seen the stats yet.
Let's see. I have the window open. 5 1/3, 8 hits, 2 earned runs, 1 walk, 1 K. So the definition of meh.
Yeah. Glad to see that the command hasn't completely left him.
No. I think, not that it's a huge jump between, A and advanced A, but there are guys that are going to barrel him, and especially in that park, compared to Grayson. It'll be something to watch going forward. But he's my number one guy. And that wraps up our... number one with a bullet. That wraps up our minor league preview. But we do have some emails of a non-minor league variety. Somehow we got more emails in the last 2 days than I got for Tuesday's episode with a full week of lag time. But it could just be because the season has started and people are getting a little excited. Though none of these are really about the... That's season either. They're just kind of, I guess, what would be hodgepodge would be the Jeopardy category, potpourri.
I think people have already turned away from the Mets.
Yes, very quickly. Not that we can blame you. But before we do emails, we do housekeeping. This is episode 62 of Amazing Avenue Audio, the official podcast of your SB Nation. New York Mets site, Amazing Avenue. You can find us on the internet at AmazingAvenue.com. Follow us on Twitter at Amazing Avenue and friend us on Facebook at facebook.com/AmazingAvenueFans. You find the podcast on iTunes. Just search for Amazing Avenue Audio and you can listen or subscribe right there. I encourage you to do both. I also encourage you to rate and review the podcast. You can also find the podcast on the Stitcher app. Download directly from blogtalkradio.com/AmazingAvenue. Or listen to the embedded player that goes up in the podcast post at Amazing Avenue proper. I'm your host, Jeffrey Paternostro. You can find me on Twitter at Jeff Paternostro. My co-host for this episode is Rob Castellano. You can find him on Twitter at _RobCast. And these are your emails. Our first one is from David Williams. Dear Jeff, Rob, maybe ? Yes. And various dogs. A history question for you, perhaps an excuse to discuss anything other than our bullpen problems. Let's suppose the Mets did not make three trades in the early 70s. Ken Singleton et al. To the Expos for Rusty Staub, Amos Otis to the Royals for Joe Foy, and Nolan Ryan to the Angels for Jim Fregosi. I realize it's been over 40 years, but I still can't get over these. I can, because I was not alive. At any rate, how many more pennants might the Mets have won with these three players from 1970 to 1980? As a teaser, consider that the 73 Mets team would have had two top 10 MVP candidates in Singleton and Otis, and the 1-2 in Cy Young voting with Seaver and Ryan, with Kuzman and Matlack forming a very nice 3-4 in the rotation. As always, thanks for the show. Best, David. I feel like this is the second question David has asked us about the 1970s Mets that we are not qualified to answer on this show.
Yeah, we can sort of go through the motions here, and again, as someone not alive at the time, I need to sort of refresh my knowledge of some of these guys, especially Amos Otis.
Amos Otis was a hell of a player.
Yeah, I mean, looking at his peak years, basically as soon as the trade is made, he's a guy who hits you like 15 to 25 home runs and bats you 300 pretty much every year. That's a valuable player.
He's a very good defensive outfielder as well. And Singleton could hit a ton. If you only know him from the Yes broadcast, and really, why are you listening to the Yes broadcast? Though he's one of the bright spots on them. I still don't know why you're listening to the Yes broadcast. He was a very, very good major leaguer as well. So I'm just going to pop up a random 1970s Mets season, say 75. So the Mets were, they were, let's see. Yeah. Not a very good offense. They were, by Fangraphs weighted runs created plus, they were the 17th best offense in the majors. And keep in mind that was a 24 team league back then. 74. Well, I haven't scrolled down far enough yet, and they're not even on the screen. So that would be the 23rd out of 24 best offense in baseball. So yeah, they could have used a couple more bats. That might have helped.
Yeah, specifically, let's say 73. Otis batted 300, 368, 44, and hit 26 home runs. Singleton, 23 home runs, 302, 425, which led the league, 479. So right there, you're suddenly looking at probably the best outfield in baseball, and certainly buoys the offense on the whole.
So I'm going to use this as a bouncing off point to talk about something more contemporaneous to our lifetimes, Rob. What's the one trade in Mets history you'd like to have back?
Oh, good question. There's a number of places I could go, but honestly, at my heart of hearts, there's only one place I can go, and that's the Kazemir trade, because it hurt me so deeply. Pain that I'll sympathize with the question. It's pain that I haven't really healed from. I just sort of numbed it to this point. But when they traded Kazemir, it really surprised me and hurt me in that I was like just starting out following prospects and like really digging deep in the Mets system, and he was like one of my first guys. And I'd pretty much already chalked up like a couple Cy Youngs and a World Series MVP for him. So that one, particularly because Victor Zambrano was just like a comedy of errors, it really hurt.
I think too, given the specific issues in that 2007, 2008 Mets team, and granted, Kazmir didn't have the longest, healthiest career, even including his more recent success, but he was pretty good in 2000, from 2006 to 2008. And given the Mets' issues with finding starting pitching those years, both in late 2006 and at all in 2007 and 2008, and given that you. As you may remember, they lost out on playoff spots by one game both years. I think having Kazmir in the rotation those years would have maybe resulted in things turning out a little differently for us.
Yes, my dreams have pretty much dictated that.
Yeah, I don't
How
have
about
a
you?
good. I think that's the answer. I
You
think
don't have
it's like I'm James Carville in Old School right now.
Yeah, that is perfect.
That is perfect. I have no rebuttal. Our next email is from Calvin, who is Met City, and he's already embracing the Loogie segment. He's got some quick hits. Hello, hello. I typically write you guys some long wordy emails. I've never read a long wordy email on this podcast from one of our listeners. I don't know what you're talking about. But I'm going to keep the word count down on this one. So we'll take these one at a time. We're going to go lightning round or Loogie round. Better relief ace potential, Vic Black or J.R.'s Familia, Rob.
I'm gonna say Familia.
I agree. I think he's about a better chance of figuring it out than Black does.
And I like the fastball a little better.
Yeah. I like the two-seamer power sinker guy, yeah. thoughts on the Savannah roster, specifically Dominic Smith's assignment there. Listen to segment one, Calvin. But I think we're both in favor.
Aye.
Better way to spend my baseball summer, watching Mets games or going to see the Brooklyn Cyclones?
Very fair question.
It is. Cyclones are cheaper. I think you can get like, what, it's like $16 to sit behind home plate, roughly.
They always win.
They always win, so there's that. The view is lovely. You can go outside and go to Nathan's.
Yeah, walk the boardwalk.
You can walk the boardwalk, which you're not doing at City unless you need a tire patched, probably.
And that's not to mention the fact that there's going to be players in Brooklyn this year.
It's going to be very sort of high ceiling prospecty with guys like Champ Stewart, Marcos Molina, Rosario. Yeah, I look. I'm not going to tell you how to spend your money, Calvin. But if the Mets haven't won a game by June 20th or so, you might want to consider going to some Cyclones games.
Yeah, I think Cyclones are always a nice, like, contingency plan too. Like, Mets have fallen off the cliff. Well, so there's the Cyclone. And especially this year, there's names. They're most likely going to have a winning season because they pretty much always do. I definitely like where his head is at.
And every single subway line that goes to Coney Island is more reliable than the 7.
What isn't more reliable than the 7?
What are the chances Jacob deGrom could be this year's Juan Lagares, i.e. converted shortstop that wasn't considered to be anything special until he came up to the majors? I like that. I like that he brought in the converted shortstop thing.
Yeah, assuming he doesn't mean that he'll become a Gold Glove center fielder.
Yeah. I think DeGrom was probably a little better at his peak. DeGrom was not as good a prospect as Lagares was at his peak as a prospect, I think. After Lagares' big breakout year, which would have been what, 2011? Yeah. But I think going into the season where they are going to get called up, DeGrom is a slightly better prospect than Lagares was. So they're both sort of like outside the top 10 guys, so I could see it. I mean, if you think DeGrom sticks as a starter, if the slider gets there and he's like a 3-4, then yeah, I could see that being a fair comp. It's certainly possible. Not likely.
Yeah, I mean,
but I like the comp.
Yeah, I definitely do. In that, he's a guy who by the end of the season we could look back and say, man, what did we do without him? Whereas right now we're sort of like
that. Could be true if he's a bullpen arm too.
Oh yeah, in whatever capacity, because I think that's probably where we're going to see him first and perhaps most impactfully, which probably isn't a word.
Yeah, we'll get to this when we get to the drinking game, but I'm going to make a note of using impactfully.
But yeah, I like the thinking that he's definitely a guy who we could sort of look back and say, oh man, he became a guy. He's definitely someone to plan around going forward. Though, it's sort of tough to follow the same sort of theme as Lagares in that he just had that amazing, unexpected breakout in the field, whereas I'm not sure where that would happen for DeGrom. I think we saw
it would be basically DeGrom coming up with like a plus to plus plus slider out of nowhere.
Yeah,
which, and if he does that, he could very much have the same impact that Lagares has with Lagares' glove.
Yeah. Okay, I buy it because he can snap off a good one from time to time.
That's not likely to happen though. But I think it's not a lazy comp. I like that comp.
Agreed.
P.S. I have a working conspiracy theory that Flores playing shortstop is all a clever ploy by Sandy to get Jeff more and more amicable to the idea of Flores being able to stick at second base. It's working.
Yeah, if so, bravo.
It's a hell of a long con. And our final email is from the not pseudonymous JJ Mack. And it's titled Drinking Avenue Audio, which really, given the Mets' performance this week, could mean anything. But it's the debut of the Amazing Avenue audio drinking game. I thought about thinking this up at some point, but I'm glad that I don't have to do it. Ahoy, Jeffrey Plus One. My highest compliments on elevating the podcast to new, dare I say, rarefied levels of greatness in year two. I really enjoyed the Montreal travelogue and found the Shortstop Avenue audio beat poetry to be finger-snappingly good. I have to say, the response to Shortstop Avenue audio has been well beyond my expectations. People are actually going out of their way to compliment me on it and not like pillory me for it is shocking, really. It seems fitting now that the podcast is coming of age, and if these first two games are any indication, we'll need every excuse we can get to inaugurate a proper Amazon Avenue audio drinking game. So here are his rule suggestions. One drink every time someone says, no, I agree, or to your point. I think that's you, Rob. To your point. One drink every time Jeffrey expresses enthusiasm for a fringy prospect. You would be in the tank right now, so I'm glad we left this to last. Take an extra drink if said enthusiasm results in a meme, or has resulted in a meme, a la Gorski or Hale. One drink every time Rob plays devil's advocate, you're going to be smashed. One drink every time Jeffrey brings up Sheffield Wednesday, you're going to the hospital. One drink every time someone earns the explicit tag. One drink every time Jeffrey mentions he too is drinking. I'm actually not for this episode. Two drinks whenever a band is referenced that Rob has never heard of but really should have. Two drinks every time someone says something that will incur the wrath of Eric Simon. I think you did that with your more impactfully. Two drinks every time Jeffrey calls a co-host who is not Rob, Rob. And finish your drink every time Jeffrey correctly answers Mets trivia. Additional rule contributions are, of course, welcome. Looking forward to spending the season of Mets baseball with you in a glorious drunken stupor. Excelsior, JJ in California. I'm going to give JJ the slow clap on the podcast. That is an 80 email. I don't have any good additions at the moment, but I encourage listeners to fire some to us either in the comments section of the podcast post, or by email.
Yeah, it's more fun when they pick up on our like mannerisms and commonalities here, because many of those I probably wouldn't have. But I guess I do play devil's advocate sort of regularly.
There definitely should be one drink for every time I say, to be perfectly honest. And I think there should also be a drink for every time I qualify absolutely excoriating with a player with saying, well, I think he's like a major leaguer. As I do it, then basically just anytime I talk about Eric Young, probably worth a drink. Anytime I excoriate a prospect or a major league player and then like walk it back or blame someone in the Mets organization for making me excoriate said player.
How about a drink for the Jeffrey, ... And I can't.
Yes, even... that's a good one. I actually haven't picked up on that, but you're right. That is. Yeah, I do the. I take my pregnant pause before I launch into some sort of rant.
Yes.
But send along those suggestions, and we'll by email read them on the podcast on our email segment, which is now over. You can send those suggestions or any emails to podcast@amazonavenueaudio.com. It's almost time to say goodbye. But Rob, let's finish up with Mets trivia. And everybody, get out your drinks.
Indeed.
Remind our listeners the question.
Once again, I wanted to know who was the first team to sign Tom Seaver to a professional Major League Baseball contract. And once again, the topicality of the question is
take another drink.
Yeah, and it should be pointed out, play this game at your own risk.
Because this is for entertainment purposes only.
Exactly. Because like I said, today actually marks the something anniversary. I think it was 66 on this date, 1966, that the Mets officially signed Tom Seaver, but not to his first contract. So who, Jeff, did sign him to his first contract?
I don't recall seeing this tweet, but I do believe it is the Atlanta Braves.
Very good. It was the Braves directly before the Mets, and there's like a long and sort of winding history of how Seaver gets to the Mets, which if you don't know it, like just pull up his Wikipedia page. It's a miracle that he ended up with the Mets.
They ended up drawing straws, essentially, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, there's even more. I'll start sort of in the middle of the saga, but he signs, or he's drafted by the Dodgers, basically his hometown Dodgers. He's a Fresno kid, and they won't pay him So the following year,
isn't he from Fresno? That's actually nowhere near LA.
Yeah, I mean, I'm talking Cali team.
All so right,
good for a Northeast guy. It's all the same to me. The following year, the Braves sign him. After drafting him in the first round, but the contract is voided because he had played in a couple of like exhibition games. Even though he didn't actually play, he was on the bench for those games and they were like sort of controversial, but in any case, the contract is voided and they decide based on his father's complaints that it's unfair that he has to wait another year, because the NCAA has now ruled him ineligible since he's been drafted. The commissioner at the time decides the best way to resolve this is to just ask which teams would offer as much as what the Braves had offered, being the Mets, Phillies, and Indians. And the Mets happened to just win the lottery of those three teams and were given the right to offer him that contract, which he then signed.
So there you go, a little bit of Mets history on the podcast with your Mets trivia, which I am now running a two-question winning streak on, which may be a longer winning streak than the Mets will see this year.
Sadly, you are right.
Yeah, there's no... Yeah, that's it. We're done here. But we'll see you next week. And maybe the Mets will have won a game by then. For episode 63 of Amazing Avenue Audio.